Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. On a case that I did not expect to cover, but was, like the rest of the nation and even the world, so invested in and horrified by, that when I knew I was going to Indiana around Thanksgiving to see Greg's family, I couldn't not invest a little bit more time in. What I had planned to do was a 10-minute or so update, but after seeing the Monon trails of Delphi, and then, eerily, walking down a hill, just for the sole purpose of just seeing how far we were from the Monon High Bridge, I had such an emotional reaction to the point where I told Greg, I've seen enough. I'd like to go. And I had seen enough. I know I felt likely 0.00001% or even less of the horror those two girls felt, but I felt so hard for them that I couldn't not make this an episode. Especially since, as of a few days ago, they released a document that no one thought would be released in this investigation. On Tuesday, November 28th, as I was writing this episode, that document opened a whole new world of terror. This is the heartbreaking story of the two beautiful little angels, Abigail Williams and Liberty German. Their short-lived but inspired lives, and the monster who took them from their family that loved them so deeply, their community that still continues to mourn, and frankly, the world. And the man on the Monon Bridge and how he hid in plain sight.
We have found two bodies. Is that the Sugar Creek?
Deer Creek.
In Deer Creek, about a mile east of town. We are investigating this as a crime scene.
Testimony from witnesses describing a creepy man on the bridge where Abby Williams and Libby German were last seen alive.
Mention of that is he could be living right amongst us, hiding in plain sight.
This is the first major update since Richard Allen was arrested last month and charged with Abby and Libby's murder.
That's what the courts will decide, right? But I'm confident. I've always had confidence.
Then discovered one of those guns matched an unspent round discovered within just 2 feet of the girls' bodies. He voluntarily went to state police and told them he couldn't explain how that bullet got there. Police say
if it were your child, would you have an option not to be hopeful?
No, absolutely not.
That's why we're hopeful.
Police have never said how they died. When police found their bodies 2 days after they went missing, an FBI agent noted that it appeared the girls' bodies were moved and staged. Before their death, one of the victims says gun, and then there's the unspent bullet at the scene. Forensic teams linked that to Allen's gun.
I chose gluttony as the sin for this case because even though it does not involve overconsumption in the traditional sense, the egregious, gluttonous nature of this crime is hard to ignore. It was broad daylight. They were little kids. He could have been caught at any point in time. I mean, I couldn't get over how open that forest was in the winter. There's not leaves on the trees. You can see across the creek. You can see hundreds of feet ahead of you. Again, he was hiding in plain sight.
I mean, Greg, in the middle of the afternoon, where you can, it's not like it's a lush forest.
Well, yeah, it's fall. I mean, it would be in the summertime, hard to see through anything, but.
How bold do you have to be? Additionally, there's no way that they were his first victims. You would not be that bold. There's no way. Look, I can see everything. I mean, I can see straight through the trees right now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you can see.
The forest is so not private that I really have to pee, and I can't find a place to hide and pee, let alone commit a murder.
But let's start from the beginning. These two girls went to entertain themselves on a school day off in only the way a small town kid can do. Explore. Get out. Have an adventure. When my best friend Sabrina and I were kids, we were so bored in an extremely small town, similar to Delphi, around 3,000 people. We would sneak out of our bedroom some nights and just walk around and then throw ourselves into a ditch at the first sign of headlights. Because the town was so small, anyone at any time could have profiled us as the girls looking for an adventure. We lived in fear of being caught, of innocently escaping boredom. But what the perpetrator of one of the most blatant crimes in the same size town didn't do was show any fear. In fact, the lack of fear was so sociopathic, it's almost like he fed off of it. Now let's be clear that all suspects are innocent until proven guilty. But Richard Allen, who was arrested around October 28, 2022, is the prime suspect in the murder of these two little girls. He was formally charged with two counts of felony murder, which in the state of Indiana could subject him to the death penalty. But let's first focus on the girls. Libby and Abby had had the previous Friday off school, and now this Monday off school for makeup snow day, giving them a long weekend. But there would be no snow in the forecast. The temperature was around 40 degrees, enough to just wear long sleeves and maybe bring a backup jacket if going outside. And because of his extra day off, the girls had had a sleepover at Libby's house, which was owned by Libby's grandparents, Becky and Mike Patty. Libby's father, Derek, also lived there. The Sunday before their Monday snow day, the girls ate pizza and worked on an art project while listening to music. The art project was chocolate-themed. They then watched movies with Libby's older sister, Kelsey, who also lived there. And they went to bed for a bit until, like any bored young person in a small town, they awoke around 2:45 a.m. and made goofy videos of themselves. Anything to entertain yourself at that age. Carrie Timmons, who is Libby and Kelsey's mom, lived over 200 miles away in Kentucky. And that Monday morning, around 9 a.m., Carrie sent Libby a good morning Snapchat, and then Libby sent one back around 10 a.m. while she was still in bed. So Abby and Libby started their day around 10 a.m., and Libby's dad, Derek, made them banana pancakes. Then around lunchtime, the girls were bored and restless, and so while Kelsey, Libby's older sister, was getting ready for work, they both swung open the bathroom door and coyly begged for Kelsey to take them to the Monon Trails. Both the little girls were amateur photographers, and they loved to take pictures, and they thought that would be the perfect spot that day. Kelsey originally said no. She had plans with her boyfriend, and then she had work. But then she felt guilty, as she had been telling her little sister no a lot lately. And she said, okay, if grandma says yes, and you can find a ride home, I'll drop you off. So then Becky, Libby's grandma, said yes, and her dad Derek agreed to pick them up around 3:30. Apparently, Abby had not run this by her mom, but her mom in later interviews said she would have agreed to it. After all, it was a popular hangout for youngsters in the area, a popular photo-taking, Instagram-worthy destination. In fact, Becky, Libby's grandma, had actually thought one of their friends was there that day, so they would have had extra company. But as it turns out, she had already left for the day. So Abby and Libby were dropped off around 1:40 p.m. And according to a wonderfully laid out blog called Actus Reus, I encourage you guys to go look at it. At 1:40 p.m., Kelsey drops them off at an entrance off the Monon High Bridge Trail that is across from the Mears Farm, an unofficial parking area. They were not dropped off at the Freedom Bridge parking area, which is where I believe Greg and I parked because the Freedom Bridge was the first place we crossed over when we went there. So Kelsey watches the girls walk until they got onto the trail. Kelsey does not notice anything unusual at the parking area before driving off. But one note of interest is that Libby was the only one of the two girls with a cell phone. And unfortunately, She had reset her phone about a week before the murders because the phone kept freezing on her. According to her grandma, when Libby reset the phone to factory reset, many of the apps like Find My Phone did not get reset. This is why they could not use the Find My Phone app to find Abby and Libby the day the girls went missing. And now here's where I'm going to weave in the recently released probable cause affidavit into this timeline of events. So who is Richard Allen? Well, he is a licensed pharmacy tech at the local Delphi CVS. And at the time of his arrest, he was 50 years old, making him about 45 when the murders were committed. According to online records retrieved by The Independent, Allen has lived in Delphi since at least 2006 and resided in Indiana throughout his whole adult life. He appears to have no prior criminal record, just a few speeding tickets and one notable incident where his wife had to bring him to the hospital at 3:30 a.m. for being too drunk. While it is unknown if his wife knew of his possible involvement in the murders, one chilling photo posted to her Facebook, a selfie of her and her husband at a local bar with a long caption supporting the bar. But in the background, there's the police sketch of potentially her husband, who is now an alleged murderer, visibly behind them. Additionally, composite sketches were posted of the suspect, potentially or allegedly, Richard Allen at his place of work, the local CVS. So he walked into work every day and saw that sketch. And the most chilling? Libby's family went to the CVS to develop photos for the girl's funeral, and Richard Allen was the one to process them. And then, further, not charge them and say, it's for the funeral. Essentially, it's on me. I got it.
Can I just ask you one question? Maybe you can put a rumor to rest or something. There's a report going around right now that this Mr. Allen actually processed some photos for the family at the CVS. Do you know if that's accurate?
That is accurate.
Okay, and that he didn't charge the family when they came in to claim the photos?
That is correct.
Okay, and you know that firsthand. We are always there.
Hiding in plain sight is an understatement in this case. I mean, if this man is responsible for these crimes, this is just so chilling. Furthermore, and trigger warning here, according to the recently released probable cause affidavit, the girls' bodies were posed, and the suspect took undisclosed trophies from the victims. One can only imagine what those were. But back to the timeline. At approximately 2:05 p.m., Libby uploads to Snapchat a picture of the Monon Bridge. At 2:07, Libby uploads a picture of Abby walking on the bridge to Snapchat. Both of these snaps were posted directly to Libby's story, meaning it was a post that was viewable to any one of Libby's added friends on Snapchat. At an unknown time after the two Snapchat uploads, Libby starts taking a video on her cell phone. Police say the girls mostly talk about stuff girls talk about in the recording. But later the girls mention a man that they noticed behind them on the bridge. The sheriff says it appears the girls initially took pictures for fun, but later became uncomfortable and recorded the video as precaution. In the release video, it is believed that Libby's perspective is from the southeastern side of the bridge, looking backwards towards the northwestern side of the bridge. According to the probable cause affidavit that was recently released, one of the girls says gun. And then this audio is captured and was released by the police in two press conferences, one with the cleaned up audio and a very emotional speech by Superintendent Doug Carter, which can be heard here. The suspect's audio is at the end, but I encourage you to listen to the whole clip.
Information is being released today is the result of literally thousands and thousands of hours of extraordinary investigative efforts by Delphi, Carroll County, the FBI, the Indiana State Police, and countless other agencies. This community surrounded us some 26 months ago and you did everything you could to support us, but most importantly, you surrounded the family of these two little girls. Gosh, I'll never forget it. After you hear what we're going to release today, I'm going to ask for your continued support, your continued understanding, your empathy and compassion as we move forward to find out who did this, and we will. We're seeking the public's help to identify the driver of a vehicle that was parked at the old CPS DCS welfare building in the city of Delphi that was abandoned on the east side of County Road 300 North next to the Hoosier Heartland Highway between the hours of noon to 5 on February 14th, 2017. If you were parked there or know who was parked there, please contact the officers at the command post at the Delphi City Building. We are releasing additional portions of the audio recording from that day. Please keep in mind, the person talking is one person and is the person on the bridge with the girls. This is not two different people speaking. Please listen to it very, very carefully. We are also releasing video recovered from Libby's phone. This video has never before been previously released. The video shows a suspect walking on the bridge. When you see the video, watch the person's mannerisms as they walk. Watch the mannerisms as he walks. Do you recognize the mannerisms as being someone that you might know? Remember, he is walking on the former railroad bridge. Because of the deteriorated condition of the bridge, the suspect is not walking naturally due to the spacing between the ties. During the course of this investigation, we have concluded the first sketch released will become secondary as of today. The result of the new information and intelligence over time leads us to believe the sketch, which you will see shortly, is the person responsible for the murders of these two little girls. We also believe this person is from Delphi, currently or has previously lived here, visits Delphi on a regular basis, or works here. We believe this person is currently between the age range of 18 and 40, but might appear younger than his true age. Directly to the killer, who may be in this room. We believe you are hiding in plain sight. For more than 2 years, you never thought we would shift gears to a different investigative strategy, but we have. We likely have interviewed you or someone close to you. We know that this is about power to you, and you want to know what we know. And one day, you will. A question to you. What will those closest to you think of? They find out that you brutally murdered two little girls. Two children. Only a coward would do such a thing. We are confident that you have told someone what you have done. Or at the very least, they know because of how different you are since the murders. We try so hard to understand how a person could do something like this to two children. I recently watched a movie called The Shack. And there's also a book that talks so well about evil, about death, and about eternity. To the murderer, I believe you have just a little bit of a conscience left. And I can assure you that how you left them in that woods is not what they're experiencing today. To the family, I hope that you all will give them some time, because we're going to be asking that there's no media inquiry or no media response for at least the next 2 weeks, and I hope you understand why. The family found out about this information this morning. I just want the family to know that when I take my last breath on this earth, I'll be thinking of them. There's going to be a tremendous amount of questions. I know that. Never in my career have I stood in front of something like this. Please be patient with us. Please. We're just beginning. We are just now beginning. And I can tell you on behalf of the sheriff and the police chief, so many other partners, that have stood with us over this period of time, that we will not stop.
The path the girls and offender took after leaving the bridge is unknown, but it was down the hill. And the girls were left near the shallow section of the creek, which is where I believe Greg and I inadvertently went to see how far we were from the bridge.
Very well, you can still see through the trees, but it does feel a lot more remote when you go literally down the hill or stay next to the water. Oh, it's so sad. Oh, it's just so sad.
So then at about 3:11 p.m., Libby's grandmother, Becky, has said call records show that Derek called Libby at 3:11, intending to tell them that he was getting close and they should start heading back to be picked up. As a point of reference, Derek remembers he was just starting to drive over to the Wilson Bridge when he makes this 3:11 p.m. call. But his daughter does not answer his call. He pulls into the parking area around 3:14 p.m., and does not see the girls. He then calls Libby's phone again, but no one picks up. And he knows it's not like Libby to ignore his texts and phone calls, especially when she was expecting him to call. He parks his car, and he begins walking the trails to search for the girls. It's 4 p.m., and at this point, the family have been trying to get a hold of Libby for half an hour with no response. They're starting to get so worried. So then Becky and Tara decide to go to the trail to help Derek look for them. Tara drives straight to the trail while Becky makes a few calls before leaving. Becky then calls her husband, Mike, who was at work in Lafayette, and alerts him to the situation. He takes off work and drives to the trail to help search. Then they call Libby's sister, Kelsey, and alerts her to the situation. Kelsey says she'll call her work and delay her work shift by a few hours so she can help search. She leaves her boyfriend's house and starts driving to the trail. They drive up to the parking area, and Derek gets into Tara's car, which is Libby's aunt. He explains to Tara the details of where and what he has searched for on the trail so far. They briefly wait in the car for Becky and Mike to arrive so they can plan out who will search where and cover more ground. As Libby's grandma Becky is about to leave for the trail, her uncle Cody arrives, and Becky informs him of what was going on, and they drive to the trail together. They theorize about which path the girls would have taken if they were trying to walk home. They drive the two possible paths the girls could have taken, but they do not see them. At this point in time, the family is thinking the girls had somehow gotten hurt on the trail from a fall or Libby's phone had been damaged. Becky and Cody arrive at the parking area, but there are no available parking spots, so they park in a ditch nearby. It should be noted that there were several non-family vehicles and people at the trail at this time. The family members, which are Mike and Becky, the grandparents of Libby, Derek, her father, Tara, her aunt, Cody, her uncle, and Kelsey, her sister, they all meet up and start searching the area for the girls. Kelsey and Cody cross the Monon High Bridge and arrive at the southeast end. They can see down a hill to a private driveway, and they spend 20 to 30 minutes yelling the girls' names, but hear no response. From this location, Kelsey calls Libby's phone. She believes the call went through because she can hear it ring on her own phone speaker, but Kelsey does not hear it ringing in the area. Kelsey's personal belief was the trail area was quiet enough that if the phone had been near where she was standing, she would have heard it ringing. As they walk, Becky calls the cell phone company and asks if they could ping Libby's phone to locate it. But like I said, she had accidentally deleted the Find My Phone app because she had reset her phone. The time window given for law enforcement for when the offender drives his vehicle away from the parking lot ends around 5 p.m. Police arrive on scene and start searching quickly after the 5:20 p.m. call. Some people use social media to ask for volunteers to help in the search, and the town all comes together and a massive search begins. Having heard of the missing girls through social media, concerned residents showed up and aid in the search in coordination with the Carroll County Sheriff's Department, Delphi Police Department, and Delphi Fire Department. The fire station is used as a staging ground for volunteers, and together, they search the trail and surrounding area. Meanwhile, Libby's sister Kelsey goes to the police station where they ask her about what she remembers from dropping the girls off earlier. And Kelsey also shows the police the two Snapchats posted to Libby's story. And here's where we will go into the probable cause affidavit and the evidence they have against Richard Allen. Richard Allen essentially walked his way into his own arrest by placing himself on the trails back in his first interview with police back in 2017. At that time, he told the investigators he was on the trails on that day from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. Furthermore, they found an unspent round from a .40 caliber gun in between the two bodies of the victims, a bullet and round that were traced back to Richard Allen when the investigators searched his house. The case against him also includes interviews by eyewitnesses on the trail. So all of the witnesses were juveniles, so their names are redacted. And I'm just going to read directly from the probable cause affidavit. I'll skim through part of it, but I'll read you the most important parts. So interviews were conducted with three juveniles. They advised they were on the Monon High Bridge Trail on February 13, 2017. They advised they were walking on the trail toward Freedom Bridge to go home when they encountered a male walking from Freedom Bridge, which is like a newer bridge that goes over the overpass there, toward the Monon High Bridge. They described the male as, quote, kind of creepy, and advised he was wearing, quote, like blue jeans, like a really light blue jacket, and his hair was gray, maybe a little brown, and he did not really show his face. She said hi to the male, but he just glared at them. She recalled him being in all black and covering his mouth, and described him as not very tall with a bigger build, and said he was not bigger than 5'10". Another witness said that she encountered a man who matched the description of the photograph taken from victim 2's phone. She described the man she encountered on the trail as wearing a blue or black windbreaker jacket and said that it had a collar, he had his hood up, and she said that he was wearing baggy jeans and he was taller than her. She said that she also said hi to the man and he said nothing back. And she said that he was walking with purpose, like he knew where he was going. His hands were in his pockets, and he kept his head down. She did not get a good look at his face, she said, but she believed him to be a white male. There are a few more witness accounts, but the most damning is this. So investigators believe Richard Allen was the male seen by Redacted and Redacted, and the male seen in Victim 2's video. Richard Allen also told investigators he was on the trail, like I said, from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. that day. And video from Hoosier Harvest Store shows a vehicle that matches the description of Richard Allen's vehicle passing at 1:27 p.m. toward the former CPS building, which is where witnesses say they noticed a vehicle parked strangely. The clothing he told investigators he was wearing matched the clothing of the male in Victim 2's video, and the clothing descriptions provided by the two redacted individuals. And in the most damning evidence against Richard Allen, an unspent .40 caliber round between the bodies of Victim 1 and Victim 2 were forensically determined to have been cycled through Richard Allen's Sig Sauer Model P226. The Sig Sauer Model P226 was found at Richard Allen's residence, and he admitted to owning it. Investigators were able to determine that he had owned it since 2001. Richard Allen stated that he had not been on that property where the unspent round was found, though, that he did not know the property owner, and that he had no explanation as to why a round cycled through his firearm would be at that location. Furthermore, he stated that he never allowed anyone to use or borrow the Sig Sauer Model P226. Investigators believe that after the victims were murdered, Richard Allen returned to his vehicle by walking down CR 300 North. And investigators believe he was seen by this witness, who said she saw him walking back to his vehicle with clothes that were muddy and bloody. And because there's so much speculation in this case, the detectives, the Carroll County Sheriff's Department, everyone is kept so much close to their chest, it's really hard to do this podcast without having someone to talk to about it. So because Greg went with me to the Monon Trails, I wanted to just see, and he also is like, he knows guns. I mean, I was pretty confused by the unspent bullet or round of bullets. I just wanted to see what he thought and if that was damning enough evidence to arrest this guy. But they must know more. And they also are saying that there are most likely other actors involved in these murders. So what did you think? What do you think about everything, Greg?
Well, I hope they've got more evidence. It seems pretty, like, obvious from the case that they presented that, like, this has got to be the guy. He was there at the right time. He's got the right kind of gun. But it isn't concrete in a court of law, per se. The unspent round that they have, the forensics say that it was ran through a similar gun. I guess that they can say, like, it was that type of gun, but they can't say for a fact that it was that gun.
But same, he also admitted to being there.
Which, he did, but I think that could be a criminal tactic to kind of hide in plain sight, like you were saying, that, you know, he's like, yeah, I was there, but I didn't do this. And they're going to have to present something besides hearsay, which all of the witness accounts might, you know, end up being hearsay. There's nothing concrete. There's not a video, you know, proving
it's
him. Well,
there is a video of, well, here's the thing.
That you can concretely say, like, oh, that is Richard Allen.
Yeah, I think when, it's hard to know because they pinpointed him as, and they arrested him. Now when I watch the video, I'm like, well, yeah, it looks like him. But it's kind of like,
I think it is him. It's my big concern is, like, is there enough to convict him in the American court of law? And that's the scary and troublesome. You know, we've seen OJ walks free. You know, the glove didn't fit. It's like we need that concrete evidence to prove it. And outside of something paranormal, it's like it's got to be him. He was there.
Well, they also did on October 13th of 2022. They did spend hours searching his home, digging stuff up, and I believe that that's where they may have found the trophies. I think that they have more than they're saying. They've been keeping stuff close to their chest this entire investigation.
Yeah.
And so it's just, it's all of us just speculating. And I think that the Carroll County, you know, Sheriff's Department, Indiana State Police, whatever, I think that they actually have done a really good job. They're just not telling us. And I feel really bad for Doug Carter. It seems extremely emotional for him.
Yeah, it seems like it's tearing that guy up. I feel like it's got to be him, or he was aware of it. He was there to help facilitate the murder. That's why he was on the Monon Trail that day, and maybe he was honest about some things because he didn't physically commit the murders, but he was part of a child abduction ring or something that was participating in the crime.
See, part of me thinks, too, though, that the other actors involved, I think someone may have picked him up. So if his car was the suspicious car was parked from 12 p.m. to 5 p.m. at the CPS building, right? And he was seen leaving the trails bloody and muddy around 3:45, okay? First of all, or maybe they're just not releasing it. There'd be DNA in his car of the blood or whatever, but they have not said anything like that. Maybe the other actor involved picked him up as opposed to him getting in his car. I don't know, but this is an ongoing case.
Or maybe the bloodied and muddied man is not him, and he was the murderer, and in fact, Richard Allen picked up the bloodied and muddied man. I mean, they keep going back to saying that there's other parties involved.
And it's so crazy to me. I know it's a defense attorney's job to defend their client, obviously. But and we'll play a clip of his defense attorney talking right now.
Our client's the wrong guy. But that's how confident we are in our client. That's how confident we are that the evidence contained in at least what's written in the probable cause affidavit is nothing for us to worry about. We don't know what other evidence is out there, but we're confident that whatever is out there is not going to be enough to show that our client did anything here. He's confused. He's bewildered. Rick, you guys all call him Richard. His actual goes by Rick. Rick is bewildered. He's confused. He has no idea why this is going
on. With such earnest, the defense attorney says that you have the wrong guy. My guy is innocent. It's...
You know, he's an actor. I mean, that's, you know. That he's just being a good lawyer. I don't think that really has much credence. To me, it's way more astounding that that Richard Allen was willing to, one, admit that he was there during, you know, when the crime happened. He was on the Monon. And two, that he said, yeah, I have, you know, the same type of gun that was, you know, had bullets right next to the dead bodies, and I never lent it or lost it.
He also said he owned all the clothes, like the outfit. His wife even said, like, yeah, my husband has a Carhartt jacket.
It seems like their defense is honestly, like, paranormal. Like, I was there, I walked past him, it had the gun, but I didn't murder him. It was aliens, you know, or it was some... It seems almost like, and maybe he'll claim some sort of, like, crazy demonic possession defense where he's like, dude, I blacked out. I must have done it and didn't know, like... It seems like he's admitting to everything but the murder as far as, like, he's like, I was on the trail at that time. I was, attached to all these suspicions.
The only thing he literally has said that's like, oh, I wasn't paying attention because I was looking at a stock ticker. But other than that, I saw everything. It's just, it's weird.
But the witness account said he always had his hands in his pockets and he was looking down, so.
And he made them uncomfortable. But here's the thing. Why Abby... Why Libby? If he passed several juvenile girls on that trail, unless, of course, it was a planned attack. If it was a crime of opportunity, he passed several juvenile girls before he encountered Abby and Libby. Or was it just that he had them cornered on that bridge and that was the easiest way to...
Instagram account that they were communicating with or something, a fake one?
Libby was communicating with this Anthony Potts or Spots account that was run by
Shots.
A guy named... Shots, there we go, sorry. That was run by a guy named Keegan Klein. Now, a lot of people had said that Keegan and Richard Allen are not connected, and Keegan apparently has come forward and helped out with the investigation, but Keegan also said that several people had the password to that account, and he also had lured girls for his own dad, so I don't know. No one really knows at this point.
Yeah, I don't know if I believe that's not connected. And he's like admitting to... Is he getting in trouble?
That's all up in the air still, but... A jury trial is set for March 20th, 2023 for Richard Allen. But regardless, let's honor Abby and Libby. When I arrived, I wasn't necessarily expecting a memorial that I could contribute to, so I came unprepared when I went to the Monon Trails. But when I saw the two memorials for the girls with gifts from many people who had visited the trails since their 2017 deaths, I wanted to give my respects as well, and so I was scrambling to find something on me that I could give them. But I think I found the perfect thing. One of my other best friends, Kristen, had given me a gold coin keychain that said, "Rock on, Gold Dust Woman." And even though it was all I had on me, I actually felt that it was pretty appropriate to give Libby and Abby, to show them that even in their afterlife, they could be anything they wanted to be and they still can. They were robbed of their time on Earth, but the stars abound with what these rock star little girls can do, watching over their families, being the best of friends in heaven together, being at peace. So with that, I say to these beautiful girls, fly, baby, fly. You were meant for a peace only the heavens can provide. Thank you guys so much for listening. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts. And I love you. See you next week.